Shall we open our Bibles to Isaiah chapter 44? You know, Isaiah has been called the preeminent theologian of the Old Testament. And that, I think, is a fitting description because we see some depth of theology in this book, not only regarding God and His relationship to His people, which we looked at last time in Isaiah 44, but also His extensive knowledge of the other gods, the false gods. He knew how to debunk their systems very well. And that's what we're going to look at today in verses 9 through 20 is idolatry, the idolater and his gods. Last time we looked at the Lord and his people. Well, this time we look at a fictional relationship between an idolater and his God. So let's look at verse 9. Of Isaiah 44. It says, "They that make a graven image are all of them vanity, and their delectable things shall not profit. And they are their own witnesses. They see not, nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who hath formed a god or molten a graven image that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his fellows shall be ashamed, and the workmen, they are of men. Let them all be gathered together. Let them stand up. Yet they shall fear, and they shall be ashamed together. The smith with the tongs both worketh in the coals, and fashioneth it with hammers, and worketh it with the strength of his arms. Yea, he is hungry, and his strength faileth. He drinketh no water, and is faint. The carpenter stretches out his rule, he marketh it out with a line, he fitteth it with planes, he marketh it out with the compass, and maketh it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man, that it may remain in the house. He heweth him down cedars, and taketh the cypress and the oak, which he strengtheneth for himself among the trees of the forest. He planteth an ash, and the rain doth nourish it. Then shall it be for a man to burn, for he will take thereof and warm himself. Yea, he kindleth it, and baketh bread. Yea, he maketh a god, and worshipeth it. He maketh it a graven image, and falleth down thereto. He burneth part thereof in the fire, which with part thereof he eateth flesh. He roasteth roast, and is satisfied. Yea, he warmeth himself, and saith, Aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire. And the residue thereof he maketh a god, even his graven image. He falleth down unto it, and worshipeth it, and prayeth unto it, and saith, Deliver me, for thou art my God. They have not known, nor understood, for he has shut their eyes, and they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. And none considereth in his heart, neither is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I have burned part of it in the fire. Yea, also I have baked bread upon the coals thereof. I have roasted flesh and eaten it. And shall I make the residue thereof an abomination? Shall I fall down to the stalk of a tree? He feedeth on ashes. A deceived heart hath turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, Is there not a lie in my right hand? Pastor DeMar, would you lead us in prayer? Amen. All right. Well, let's go ahead and pick it up here in verse 9 and give you a little background of where we've been. We considered the Lord and his people. And when we looked at that, we saw the Lord's ability to self-determine. And what is the phrase that is often associated with that fact? Anybody? I will. I will. We see it many times regarding the Lord. And then we saw another thing about God, and that is that he self-exists. He doesn't exist depending on us. He doesn't derive his life from any one of us or even from this planet. If the planet dies, God does not die. He exists independent of his creation. And so what is the phrase that goes with that? I am. I will and I am. And these phrases have been used again and again to show the uniqueness of God from all the other gods that claim to be a candidate for deity. And Israel was his witnesses to this fact. But now as we look at the Lord and the idolater and his God, it's a deep contrast with verses 6 through 8, because immediately in verse 9, you see all of the initiative and the activity is now on the human side, not on their God side. You see the reversal? And outside of the Lord, there are only man-invented gods. You know, whether we're talking about archaic ancient gods of ancient times, which people made statues of, or we're talking about the things that people trust today that are the object of man's creation, we're talking about the same thing. And it is something outside the Lord that is a man-invented God. And so this passage, there's a lot of comedy in this passage. You noticed that probably. And this passage isn't just a taunt at false worship, at false religions, but it's a penetrating analysis of the human need for the true and living God. Man needs the true God. And he's trying to drive not only Israel to see that the folly of these other nations, there was peer pressure as they would have been in captivity. They would have been in the midst of all of this idolatry, surrounded by a huge majority of idolaters. And here's little Israel who believes in monotheism. And so there would have been peer pressure. So this is a penetrating analysis of the human need for the true God and the absurdity of devotion to man-made devices. According to Motyer, that's well said. So let's look at verses 9 through 11, where we see the vanity of idolatry. It says, verse 9, woe unto him. Sorry, wrong chapter. Verse 9, they that make a graven image are all of them vanity. You know, when we see the word graven image in the Bible, we're talking about a representative of deity. And Isaiah chooses to attack false religions at their weakest point, at their Achilles heel, you might say. And that Achilles heel is idol making, the industry of God making. And I like what one commentator says about this, that idol making is the folly of believing that supreme power rests in a block of wood that was a tree until someone cut it down and with great effort made it into a god. So this is the folly of idol making. But notice who he's talking to. He's not talking to the idols. He's not targeting the idols and talking about them because they're not real. He's talking about the people that made them, they that make carved images. He's targeting them as vanity. And, you know, paganism is the worship of something within creation, something that is locked within the cycles of nature, therefore incapable of changing anything for its worshipers. What good does that do? And so he calls them vanity, not just the idols, but them that worship the idols. Now, you think about what God had done, what happened for Israel because of their relationship with Jehovah. What did that do for them? Well, it greatly raised their position in the world, didn't it? It made them a special people, peculiar people. It gave them status as a people where once they didn't have status. Their relationship with Jehovah gave them significance. But what does the idolaters' relationship with their God give them? Well, vanity, nothing, no significance, no net gain is given here by their religion. And because of their alliance with these gods who are nothing, they are nothing. You know, nothing is the meaning of the word vanity. And let me just give you a few synonyms of the word vanity. All of these would be valid translations of the word, of the same Hebrew word: useless, empty, profitless, no advantage, nothing, and really summing it up, no net gain. Now, you may even think of what Paul said about his own works. He took it a step farther, didn't he? And he said, what things were gain unto me, those I counted loss, even liability. Paul took it that far in his religion. He trusted something outside of the Lord, and he says, you know, that was a liability to me. It wasn't not only empty, it was a loss. And so Isaiah calls these things no net gain through this religion. You know, that's the same way that God described. Let's take that thought of emptiness and vanity and nothing, because we see the same word, almost the same exact word used in Genesis 1, where it says the earth was without form and void. Remember that? and the earth before it was affected by God, its creator, was empty. But then God acted and there was meaning to it. And so is these religions. Without the true and living God, there is emptiness. But let's look at the word, you know, nothing as it's used in the scriptures. There's some interesting passages that shed light. And let's take one in John 15 in verse 5. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me, ye can do, anybody? Nothing. So we're seeing in the scriptures that there's this strong statement of bankruptcy of mankind apart from God. Acts chapter 5, verse 38. And now I say unto you, refrain from these men and let them alone. This is Gamaliel speaking about the early Christian movement. For if this counsel or this work be of men, it will come to nothing. Well said. And let's go to another one. First Timothy 6:7. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. So what is man on his own, even at the best of his human efforts, the product of the pinnacle of his production? It is, according to the scriptures, nothing. And so we approach the idols with that viewpoint. Isaiah says they are all of them vanity, going back to Isaiah 44:9. And then he goes on, their delectable things shall not profit. Delectable things really means things they delight in. In other words, Isaiah wasn't denying that they found joy in their idols. There was an emotional infatuation with their idols. You may even relate this to people today who trust in things other than God, and that often is a good description. Emotional infatuation. Eventually those things bottom out, prove to be faulty and vanity. But there is an infatuation. Let's go on and look at verse 10. And before we do that, it says they are their own witnesses. They see not nor know that they may be ashamed. The point here is that the idolaters, they have a brain that God gave them and they're not using it. They are witnesses of the fact these graven images don't do anything. They don't have a brain themselves. They don't see. They could know better if they wanted to. God gave them that ability. But because they've chosen to trust in blind and non-intelligent idols, by trusting them, they then become blind and unintelligent and ignorant. So that's the statement he's making here. Now, this thought here of, let's go on to verse 10, and he develops that thought. Who hath formed a god or molten a graven image that is profitable for nothing? And the thought here is, going back to the end of verse 9, he says, that they may be ashamed. And the point here is that the idolater, his conscious will is involved in this process. They must know what the end result will be, Isaiah is saying. And the question in verse 10 is, who does that? Who endorses a religion which they have to know will end up with nothing? Who does that? And so it's an incredulous statement here in verse 10, a question that is profitable for nothing. You know, he says something interesting. Who hath formed a god or a graven image? Notice that God formed us out of the dust of the ground and made man a living soul, breathed into him the breath of life, and he became a living soul. And not only that, God formed Israel. We already saw that multiple times, like back in chapter 40, over in 44:2. Thus saith the Lord that made thee and formed thee from the womb, which will help thee. You know, back in 43, verse 1, the same thing. I've redeemed thee, I've formed thee, O Israel, fear not. And so there's the contrast couldn't be more clear. Here, the God of Israel formed them, but the false gods were formed by their worshipers. But there's another interesting thing here in verse 10. The thought here is that whoever has shaped a god has cast an idol. They've gone about with the intention to achieve deity, but they've accomplished only something material. That's the thought. It's very interesting. You remember when Israel came up out of Egypt, they're in the wilderness and Moses is up in the mountain and he was tarrying up there a long time. And they said to Aaron, up, make us gods. And the intention was to make deity, but the result was only to make a cow that was made out of gold with no actual value, but to symbolize party time for the people. And a wicked party ensued. So let's go back to Isaiah 44 and look at verse 11. And he solidifies this point of the vanity of idolatry. Behold, all his fellows shall be ashamed, and the workmen, they are of men. They shall be gathered together, let them stand up. Now, his fellows could refer to the fellow witnesses, the fellow worshipers of these false gods, but more than likely it refers to the fellow craftsmen who made these gods. Everybody involved in the manufacturing process of idols, everybody all down through the line who contributes to this industry is considered his fellows. Now, in Israel in captivity, as I mentioned earlier, might say, how can we be right when there are so many of them and so few of us? How can we be right about there being the one true God when there's so many of them? And Isaiah says it doesn't matter. Verse 11, the point is, it doesn't matter how many of them there are. They'll all be put to shame. You know, we need to have the strong confidence as Christians that consensus does not determine truth. Truth is based on the Scriptures. Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God. And we need to have our confidence not based in the ebb and flow of culture, but in the Word of God. I need no other argument. I need no other plea. You know, it is enough that Jesus died and that He died for me. So believers, you know, it's always going to be the case. And let's not kid ourselves about this. Believers in the true and living God will always be in the minority and out of the mainstream. Now, today we're being pushed further and further from the mainstream, sadly. But that's to be expected in a world where men's minds are blinded to the truth of the glorious gospel of Jesus Christ. That's to be expected. Notice what happens to those that worship these gods. It says in verse 11, they shall be ashamed together. There apparently is going to be some climax moment when they'll meet their true maker and their false gods will be proven to be false. Let me show you what that shame looks like in Revelation chapter 20, verse 11. And, you know, Asaph really struggled with this whole conflict. And then he was brought to his senses when he considered their latter end, the latter end of the wicked and the pagan. Revelation chapter 20, verse 11. And I saw a great white throne and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. That's shame. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were open. And another book was open, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which were written in the books according to their works. So men will meet their true maker in the end. It's so wonderful to know that we know the living and true God. So let's talk about what Isaiah has accomplished here and what he's going to accomplish in this whole essay. How is it possible that the mundane could create the transcendent, or that the finite could create the infinite, or that the mortal could create the eternal? We're talking about men trying to create God, right? Or that the material could create the spiritual. Those are a contradiction of terms, because the idol, if you think about it, can't rise above the one who originated it. That's just a general rule of thumb. The thing that we make is not going to be any smarter than the person who made it. We learn that about the Lord, right? And He created the heavens and the earth. It follows that He's smarter than anybody in the heavens and the earth. Well, if the idolaters created their gods, it follows that they're going to be, the gods will never be smarter than their worshipers. They'll be as dumb and ignorant as them. So these are a contradiction of terms. Now let's go on. And consider the industry of idolaters. It's a little hard to see there, but there's a guy with a hammer pounding a piece of red-hot metal. And let's look at verse 12. So we saw the vanity of idolatry, and now we get into the nuts and bolts of it, the industry of it. This is where we could have a lot of fun and look at the picture that is painted. Verse 12. The smith with the tongs both worketh in the coals and fashioneth with hammers and worketh it with the strength of his arms. Now, what he's going to do is he's going to take the final product, the final idol, from its finished product and its glistening beauty, and work backwards from different to each previous stage of industry. And the final stage is when the metal is applied to the wooden form. Okay, this is what the final product comes out and is ready for sale. Okay? And so the guy that's called the smith here in verse 12 is a forger. That's what that is, a metal worker. And this is a craft. This is a real profession that, you know, forging has come a long way since the days of Isaiah. People back then used it with just elbow grease and a hammer. But today they've gotten to be so large in forging processes that you have presses out there that are capable of 50,000 tons of force. Not using human arms, obviously, but using hydraulic pressure and other things. But this is a real thing here, focused on the ingenuity and the craftsman of the craftsman who's making the metal. And you think about what it takes to form metal. Metal forming is an industry, a huge industry. And it says here that the guy has to heat them up in the coals in verse 12. And that's forging is usually a three-stage process. You have to heat the material up and so that it's not so stubborn in taking a shape. So temperature control is a big deal. And they've got to put it in the coals. Then you actually do the pressing of the material, the forging of the material, where you give it a shape. And in order to forge a material, you have to have something called a die or something to press it onto where it gets its shape from. And where do you think that design comes from? Well, the material is just dumb. Everybody knows that. The design comes from the person, the metal worker, and his ingenuity is it all depends on that. And so humanity is creating his God in his own image. And the material is dumb, and it takes the shape designed for it by the craftsman. It's very important that you see that. And then finally, you would temper the material as the final stage of forging. And that's done many times with water quenching. That's not seen here in this verse, but we did see it earlier in when it describes how God formed Israel in chapter 43. It says, though you go through the water and through the fire, I will be with you, and I've formed you, was the point. Process is required for forging. God did that for Israel. Well, here you have an idolater doing that for his God. Now, you tell me, of what value would that God be to the craftsman or those to whom he would sell this product? Of no more value than the craftsman himself. And so, now, when we talk about metal forming, and we see an ancient process here where they would pound the metal into shape while it's red hot. And I mentioned that forging has come a long way over the years. People have gone to great lengths to eliminate something called human error. And whenever you make something by hand, you have the risk of making it wrong. And quality control is very difficult when people do things by hand. Anyone here that's in the business of that knows how difficult that would be. So you have to have automation. And a lot of presses today are automated so that the operator doesn't do a whole lot. But you know, it always does come down to either the operator or the person with the joystick or the controls engineer who writes up the program to make the forging press work. It always comes down to some guy or some person, some human being. That's what limits the process. It's only going to be as good and as smart as the human being that's controlling it. Whether we're talking about the ancient processes of forging or the modern ones, it always comes down to human ingenuity. Notice the second part of verse 12. This is very interesting. It says, He worketh it with the strength of His arms. And this is a picture of human power here. This thing that He makes is a monument to His own ingenuity. There was something I was working on my job and looking at. And I was thinking, how can I work this into one of my presentations? And so finally, this verse gave me an opportunity. This is the 50,000-ton forging press that I was telling you about. You know what the problem with this press is? It's cracked at the bottom. And this is a press in Ohio that threatened to shut down an entire plant because it broke. This thing has been in existence for probably around half a century. And working 50,000-ton press is huge. And you can imagine how many people that employs to keep it in operation. But in the end, not only does human strength have its limits, human devices and things that man has made also has a lifespan and a limit. And so this thought here of the forger working with the strength of his arms, whether we're talking about his literal arms or the strength of the cylinder that that man has designed, such as we have right here, it has its limits. And that's made very clear at the end of verse 12. He works with the strength of his arms, yea, he is hungry, and his strength faileth. He drinketh no water and is faint. Now, this is wearisome, complex work. This guy, after all, there's a production quota for the person making idols. You know, there's a god being made here. People are really depending on this. And so he's probably working three shifts, probably working all his people overtime to get these idols made. And believe me, this was an industry in those days. And if you don't believe that, let's go to the book of Acts, chapter 19. Let's go to the book of Acts 19, verse 23. This is a great example of what an industry this is for ancient pagan societies. Acts 19, verse 23. And this is the result of Paul coming to Ephesus and doing some miracles and converting some people. And it says, the same time there arose no small stir about that way, Christianity, for a certain man named Demetrius, a silversmith, just like what we looked at in Isaiah, a craftsman, which made silver shrines for Diana, brought no small gain unto the craftsmen, whom he called together with the workmen of like occupation and says, sirs, ye know that by this craft we have our wealth. Moreover, ye see and hear that not alone at Ephesus, but almost throughout all Asia, this Paul hath persuaded and turned away much people, saying that they be no gods which are made with hands. So that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. And, in other words, these Christians are bad for the economy. And when they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath and cried out, saying, great is Diana of the Ephesians. And they went on with this chant, this protest about Diana. Now, they said that this god, this goddess, Diana, this image of Diana actually was supposed to have fallen from heaven. And these craftsmen were peddling a religion which they knew was man-made. They made it. And they made a lot of money off of it. But you see that it's an industry. It's exhausting. And this guy in verse 12 of Isaiah chapter 44 is in the middle of a production where no downtime is allowed. Dead cycle time is the enemy. And the strength of his arms, he begins to be hungry. He's failing in his strength. What does that sound like, this man with failing strength? Does that remind you of another verse in Isaiah? Well, it should. It should immediately signal us to Isaiah chapter 40, where, you know, if he looked up to the God who created him instead of down to the gods that he created, he would discover the one who fainteth not and gives power to the faint. What an interesting contrast, very, very clear contrast between the false gods of the idolater. So let's look at that very quickly in Isaiah 40, verse 28. Hast thou not known, hast thou not heard, that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary, There is no searching of his understanding. He giveth power to the faint, and to them that have no might he increaseth strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. And Israel need not be weary, need not be faint, even in their captivity, because Israel's God carries them. They don't have to carry him. That's the lesson here. God doesn't depend on the strength of his worshipers, but these false gods do. So let's go on to verse 13. And we move backwards a step, because before the metalworking takes place, there's this form underneath that's made of wood, and that's carpentry. In verse 13, let's read it. The carpenter stretcheth out his rule. He marketh it with a line, fitteth it with planes, marketh it out with compass, maketh it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man that may remain in his house. The picture on the left is the picture of a carpenter doing woodwork. Maybe you have heard of the carving museum that's down in Dover, Ohio. Anybody been to that? What's the name of that? And it slipped my mind. Werther Carving Museum. And that is a fascinating place. This is a guy that carved. His claim to fame is this pair of pliers that he was able to carve in wood. And then he was able to, with each leg of the pliers, carve another pair of pliers, each with moving parts, until there was like hundreds. I think the biggest one that he got, I forget how many, but it's like the basis of a mathematical equation. This guy was a real craftsman, and he never graduated from high school, I don't believe. Just an amazing thing. If you ever get a chance, you might want to check out that museum. But he also carved ivory. He carved complete train engines and all the parts, the moving parts in the train locomotives with ivory and wood. And it's incredible to scale and everything. But a brilliant craftsman. And carpentry is the work of a craftsman. And so look at what he's doing here in verse 13. He's taking all these different measuring tools and cutting tools. The rule is a string that he would snap on a thing. Any carpenter knows what that is. And with that, he's making a guide for the basic form. Okay, the rough form with that string. And then he marks it with a sharp-pointed stylus. He takes and he marks where that string's at. And then he fits it with planes. That means he takes files and chisels and he cuts that image out. Okay, this is just the rough part of the piece of wood. And then he takes a compass. And with that compass, he then gives it the fillets and the little curvature that is required to give it the fine detail to make it a really beautiful piece of wood. But notice what is the end result here. He makes it after the figure of a man, according to the beauty of a man. Now, the craftsman, the best that he can do is to give it the most glorious thing that he can think of, and that is humanity. What are you given by the idolater? The form of a man. Now, this is fascinating because the result of all of this skill, the metalworking, the woodworking, is just humanity in all of its glory. You can't rise any higher. That's the highest you will ever go. And this is an effort, I think, as Oswald says, is to project ourselves on the heavens. There's a doctrine today called humanism. Have you heard of it? And the idea of humanism is we will be God and God will be us. And you know what? Humanism is the worship of man. The application, the practical application of it is that well-known phrase, believe in yourself. And it's peddled in the public schools and everywhere. But humanism is just a repackaging of ancient idolatry, because what did idolatry produce? Just the figure of a man. Men worshiping their own creation, which was a reflection of their ideal image of themselves. That's what they wanted to make. And so I've always thought it was interesting that the idols of ancient Greece and like Zeus here that you see on the left are always human in nature. They have two arms and two eyes and two legs and a head and very human in basic form. That's very interesting. Because pagan theology is man-centered. And the thing on the right is just a little side note. I won't even charge you for it. But the thing is, it's a face that was supposedly seen on Mars. And whenever someone sees a face of a human image or a human form, the assumption is immediately, oh, there must be intelligent life. And I get a kick out of how all of the alien sightings all look like we do, basically, with two legs and arms and eyes. Totally off the subject. But the point is, men conceive of things in their even most creative states. They conceive of things in their own image. This is a man-made religion. That's the point. And anything outside of the Lord Jehovah is a man-made religion. And so we want to remember that, whether we're talking about ancient idolatry, which we would all say, well, that's stupid, or modern objects of man's trust, which are the work of his own creation. We're talking about the same thing, a man-made religion. So the carpenter is the second tier manufacturer in this industry of idolatry. The metal worker is the first tier. The carpenter is the second tier. And if we were comparing it to the automotive industry, let's go on to the next stage in this industry. And that stage is so we saw forging, we saw carpentry, and then logging. In verse 14, he heweth him down cedars, and taketh the cypress and the oak, which he strengtheneth for himself among the trees of the forest. Okay, so logging. And you know, not just any kind of wood was acceptable for the gods. The trees were God-specific. Each god required a certain material of wood for it to be right. And the thought here is that these trees, it was in order to cut down the wood of his choice that the craftsman planted certain trees. And it was common for heathen cultures to grow trees for the purpose of idol making, just as sheep would have been raised for sacrifice. That's the thought. Very interesting. But look in verse 14, he planteth an ash, and the rain doth nourish it. So we've gone all the way from forging to the planting of a seed. And here's the origins of the god, the seed planted in the ground. Notice that the idolater is an environmentalist. That's really nice. He plants a tree. And so, you know, it's interesting here, the care that's going into this, the selection of the trees, look at it. He strengtheneth for himself among the trees of the forest. And there's nourishment. There's husbandry of the plants and the trees. And so there's real care that's going into this idol. You know, it's interesting, the reverse picture, the real picture of God's people is presented in John 15 when Jesus said of his Father, I am the vine and my Father is the vine dresser, or the husbandman, the one who puts great care into the development of his own. It's totally different. Here in idolatry, you have people taking great care for the development of their God, but within Christianity, God takes great care in the development of us. And we're pictured as branches on that vine, without which we can do nothing. And so, what a different picture, isn't it? And so God cares for the branches, even us. I want to read a statement by Oswald, who said that the gods are completely dependent on man planting and the rain which made it grow. And the god is passive, acted upon, but incapable of independent action. Where is the activity of the gods if they have to inhabit a form wholly dependent on the human mind for its inception and upon human skills for its creation, and the gifts of nature, like rain, for its materials? There is no activity. The god is passive. So here's man in his care and effort and wearied by the process of making himself a god. Let's go to verse 15 and look at the real irony of this whole thing. Because we saw the process, but now look, this same piece of wood that was used for the making of a god is also used for other things involved in man's survival. And let's look at verse 15. then shall it be for a man to burn, for he will take thereof and warm himself. Yea, he kindleth it, he baketh bread, yea, he maketh a god and worshipeth it. He maketh it a graven image and falleth down thereto. So this is amazing. In Isaiah, the language in which he puts it is stated with awe at the lowness of intellectual level here on the part of human beings. He's saying they even kindle it and they even make bread with it. In fact, he maketh a god and worshipeth it. That's the language with which Isaiah is saying this in amazement that people could do this without realizing what they're doing. You know what's tragic here in verse 15 is that the tree was given to man. The thought here is it shall be for man to burn and to warm himself. God gave him that tree. And instead of recognizing that this tree was a gift from God and with gratitude responding to that, they turn around and make gods in their own image so they can keep the gifts of nature, so they can feel secure that they'll keep these things. That's the idea of idolatry. And so what man was given to use for his survival by the true God, man is now misusing for idolatry. Now, this is a tragic thing. And, you know, the absence of gratitude is a symptom of idolatry. We see that in Romans chapter 1. We'll go there a little bit later. But, you know, Paul had to address this issue. That which is good in and of itself is being used for a very wrong purpose, misused by man. It's similar in Paul's day when the people had a conflict in their minds with eating meat that was offered to idols. Do you remember that? There was nothing wrong with the meat, but they had a real obstacle in their conscience with eating that meat. And Paul addressed this. He had some very interesting things to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. In verse 4. As concerning, therefore, the eating of those things that are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world. Pretty much what Isaiah said, an idol is vanity. And that there is none other but God, God but one. For though there be that are called gods, whether in heaven or in earth, as there be gods many and lords many, but to us there is but one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we in Him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we by Him. Totally reversed. Howbeit there is not in every man that knowledge. For some with conscience of the idol unto this hour eat it as a thing offered unto the idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But meat commendeth us not to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, neither if we eat not are we the worse. Now the point here is that the things that God has provided still are able to be used for their intended purposes. But here's a group of people, a large group, that have used it for false religion. What a tragedy. Now, let's look at this things that he did with the wood. I guess red doesn't work real well with the projector here. He heats it for warmth. He cooks food with that same fire. And then with the rest of it, he makes a god. Three things that are stated here that he uses this piece of wood for. And there's a couple interesting points here. The material for idol making are the leftovers from an exercise in self-preservation. Whatever's left over becomes a god. Or another way of looking at it, the woodworker chooses the piece of wood carefully, which he will select, probably the best piece of wood, for god making. Just as God chose Israel from the nations and took them to be a peculiar people for himself, this idolater is choosing a piece of wood to make a god for himself. The contrast couldn't be more clear. Let's go to verse 16. He burneth part thereof in the fire, which part thereof he eateth flesh. He roasteth roast and is satisfied. Yea, he warmeth himself and saith, aha, I am warm, I have seen fire. And it's hard to read verse 16 without sounding like a caveman. And that's kind of what Isaiah accomplishes here. Here's a person with the skill of a craftsman, but with the spiritual intelligence of a caveman. And Isaiah is basically saying Asaph calls it being like a beast in Psalm 73, with no other senses than that which is for their own survival And when Asaph started to think like them, he said, I was as a beast before thee. I had no spiritual perception. That's the picture of verse 16. Aha, I am warm. I have seen fire. And so in verse 17, the residue, the leftovers, then he makes a god, even his graven image. He falls down to it and worships it, prayeth unto it, and saith, deliver me. Now let's look at the process, the ritual, the complex formula of his approach to his God. He's falling down, he's worshiping, and he's praying. And that phrase is used in verse 15, he worshipeth it. And later in verse 19, falling down to it, implying the repetition of the process. This is a much repeated cycle. It's a formula that they would have assigned themselves for their worship. And where did the formula come from? Well, the same place that the idol came from. And so the recipe for worship comes from the same source that the idol comes from. And doesn't that remind you of the words of Jesus Christ and what he had to say about vain repetition in Matthew chapter 6 in verse 7? Matthew chapter 6 in verse 7. But when ye pray, use not vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think that they shall be heard for their much speaking. Be not ye therefore like unto them, for your Father knoweth what things ye have need of before ye ask him. After this manner therefore pray ye, Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Holy, above everybody else, separate from sinners, transcendent from us, totally other than us, and beyond our perception, beyond our conception, certainly not the object of our creation. When we say, hallowed be thy name, we're talking about a God who created us, not a God that we created. So he falls down and he says, what does he say? Verse 17, deliver me, for thou art my God. Now this is amazing, because how can that, to make a quote from Oswald, how can that which humans have consumed in their own service with such great effort and care turn around and care for them? So Isaiah has argued very effectively, you know, the reason God can deliver his people is because he has not been created by them, and because he's not an extension of them, and because he does not exist to serve them. He's not beholden to them. And what do we call that when God acts on behalf of a people that he doesn't owe something to? Grace, right? And he's not one of the gods. So let's go on. What we've seen is the vanity of idolatry, the industry of idolatry, and then now finally the deception of idolatry. And we see it in verse 18. They have not known nor understood, for he has shut their eyes that they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand. Now this brings us to a difficult doctrine about God. In Isaiah, he looks at their reasoning, he looks at their lack of using their God-given mental abilities, and the only reason that one wouldn't see the obvious contradictions of verses 15 through 17 is because he cannot see. He cannot see. Some kind of blindness has been imposed. And we saw the same thought in Isaiah chapter 40 in verse 21. God asks the nations, have ye not known? Have ye not seen? Hath it not been told unto you? Haven't you understood? In other words, you should know. You have all the information you need to know about God. After all, it says about his creation that their language is spread forth throughout the whole earth in Psalm 19. Everybody should know. Everybody has what they need to know that there is a God. And yet, the only reason they wouldn't is because they cannot. Because it says he has shut their eyes. And the literal meaning is smeared from seeing, plastered over. You know, in the scriptures, we learn that God not only has the ability and the right to give spiritual sight, but also spiritual blindness. Now, you may immediately say, well, how can men be held responsible for this if God has caused the blindness? I want to read a statement. God is just, and he never punishes anyone without just cause, and does not blind a man unless he deserves it and voluntarily shuts his eyes first. You know who said that? Calvin. You may be surprised by that. The order for us is laid out very clearly in Romans chapter 1. With our few remaining minutes, we will look at this in Romans chapter 1. Because there is an order. There is a sequence in this mental spiritual decline. Romans chapter 1. And the first step is that God reveals to man in verse 19. It says, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation world are clearly seen. But stage 2 is in verse 21. Man could have acknowledged God, but he didn't want to. Verse 21, because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations. Step 3, God gives them over to blindness, and their foolish heart was darkened. Verse 24, God gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their hearts, and chaos ensues. And to quote one commentator, we did not and do not want a sovereign God to whom we have grateful and total obedience, to whom we owe that. We want a universe in our own image, whose limits and benefits are dictated by us. That end demands intellectual suicide, but that end has always seemed worth it anyway. So God visits on the pagan mind the gathering darkness it has freely chosen. So this matter of God's sovereign imposition of blindness is the result of men themselves choosing not to believe in the true and living God. And so men do have responsibility for that. Now let's go on in verse 19 and look at what it says. They have not known nor understood, verse 19, and none considereth in his heart. And the thought here of knowledge is ability to appraise something, to sift truth from error. Neither is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I've burned part of it in the fire, yea, I've baked bread. But notice what he says in the end of the verse. And shall I make the residue thereof an abomination? Now that's a strong word to use for another religion. Isaiah is not very multicultural. He's not being very tolerant. But, you know, that's an appropriate word when you consider what's at stake here. He's using an extreme term to describe other religions. Why didn't he just call it a mistake? Well, they made a mistake. You know, they made a misjudgment. Well, let's look at it this way. If an instructor was guiding a person who was an unroped climber up a rock face and sees that that person is reaching for a loose piece of granite, he might say something like, death is in your hand. You better do something different. You make another move. That's the wrong way. And so a wrong choice is not just a mistake when one's whole life rides on it. Just like that rock climber there. These are the stakes depending on our choice about deity. And that's what Isaiah is saying. These are the stakes. Your life depends on it. It's an abomination because the stakes are so high. You know, Paul uses similar language in the book of Galatians. He says, if anyone preach any other gospel to you than that which we have preached, let him be accursed. He understood what the stakes were. The eternal souls of men are resting on their decision about Jesus Christ, about the one that God has put forth to be the Savior of their souls. And you know, there is a way that seemeth right unto man, but the end thereof is the way of death. So as one commentator said, there is only one Holy One, and if the God that I'm trusting isn't Him, and if I have rested my destiny on a block of wood or the product of my efforts, then that's an unholy thing. It's an abomination, and death is in my hand. And so we say that about any works religion out there today. I hope we can see the connection between the idolatry of Isaiah's day and the works and self-help religions of our day. There's a dime a dozen out there. You can go to any church in any neighborhood and find one that's preaching a works gospel, and death is in their hands if they're trusting in their own efforts. Let's go to verse 20 and close with this verse. It says, He feedeth on ashes, a deceived heart hath turned him aside. He cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? Now this is a very shocking picture here, a closing picture to the idolatry. It's a picture of sheep grazing. The feeding literally means grazing. And it's in burnt fields. They're grazing on ashes, looking for food where there is none. That's the nature of the reality of worship in this world apart from Jesus Christ. You know, Psalm 23, by way of contrast, talks about how the Lord is our shepherd, we shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. You know, when you are pursuing and worshiping the true living God, you've trusted in Him, you're going to be fed. You're going to be a sheep of His, and you will be taken care of. But if you're one of those, if a person is trusting in a false god, something of their own human effort, they're feeding on ashes. Not only that, where do ashes come from? From burnt wood. And we just looked at ashes. They burnt the wood in the fire. And they, what do you get from that? Ashes. And the point is that the part used to make a god of that log is of no more consequence than the part burned in the fire. You may as well be praying to dead embers, is the thought. And then finally he says, is there not a lie in my right hand? It's the thought is, this lie, this delusion that I've been convinced of is attached to me. They're hooked on an idol. And they've lost all capacity to free themselves. Now, the right hand is the hand always referred to in the scriptures with which you do work, right? That's the hand that's referring to effort. And the idolater holds his idol as the product of his own strength. That's the right hand. But the reality is that the idol holds him. He can't break free from the bondage to this false thing, this lie. And Satan has got many people in bondage to the product of their own efforts. Many people today are in churches and very much enslaved to depending on the product of their own efforts for the favor of a God that they do not know. What a blessing it is today to know the true and living God, to be redeemed by Him, to be formed by Him, to be in the process of being taken care of by Him. He's forming you and me, and He's making us into the image of His own Son. It is a very different image than what we came with into this world. He is making us something completely new. And when He takes and does that, it's a new creation. He is certainly not the object of our creation. Let's close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank You for this picture that has been painted in Your Word of the fact that we know the true living God and what it is that makes You unique. And Father, I pray, give us a greater appreciation for the truth we have. Help us to reach those who are, even now, under the delusion of a lie that says that by their own effort, they can make them gods. They can trust in that thing. Father, help us to bring them the message of deliverance and hope through Jesus Christ. In His name we pray. Amen.